We're drawing nearer-ish to the end of this series, although we're making fairly slow progress. So we're in chapter 3, and we're looking at most of that passage that we read earlier. Our text is verses 7 to 13 of Genesis chapter 3. And as we look at these verses this evening, then, I have two headings. And first of all, life continued. Life continued. Our passage begins, verse 7, then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And often, that sentence is set alongside verse 5. There, the serpent says to Eve, God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And verse 7 is indeed, then, the counterpart of that verse. Then the eyes of both were opened, verse 7 says, and they knew. It's exactly what the serpent said would happen then. Except that it isn't, is it? Because the sentence ends with those four ever so anticlimactic words, they knew that they were naked. The serpent's promise then was phony. They had been deceived. So verse 7 should be set alongside verse 5. There is that very obvious connection going on there. It's appropriate to set the two alongside each other. But verse 7 should also be set alongside an earlier verse, namely chapter 2, verse 17, and God's words there, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Now remember, Adam has now eaten of it. That's what has just happened in chapter 3, verse 6. So we're now in chapter 2, verse 17 territory. Those divine words there are no longer hypothetical words like they were when they were first spoken. They now come into play, which means chapter 3, verse 7 here ought to read, then the eyes of both were closed. Closed as the pair fell to the ground dead. In the light of chapter 2, verse 17, that's what chapter 3, verse 7 should say. But no, this verse doesn't go the way which that earlier verse back in chapter 2 led us to expect. You remember, those of you who are, I don't know, maybe 35 and above, New Year's Eve 1999. And many were saying that once 12 o'clock struck, there was going to be pandemonium. The world's computer systems weren't going to cope with such a significant change in the dates. No computer, of course, had ever existed with anything but a 1 at the start of the date, and having to move to a 2 at the start of the date, they wouldn't be able to handle that, and because computer systems even back then pretty much controlled everything, everything would therefore go into meltdown. Aeroplanes would fall out of the sky. Power stations would stop operating. Phones and radios and all other means of communication would be disabled. In a stroke, we'd be plunged back into the Dark Ages. And as that New Year's Eve progressed then, it got to 11:30, and then 11:45, and then 11:55, and then we were counting down the final seconds, 10, 9, 8, and as zero approached, we were all bracing ourselves for everything to unravel, the end of civilization. And zero came, 12 o'clock on the 1st of January, 2000. And the lights in our houses stayed on. And the coverage of Tony Blair singing Auld Lang Syne in the Millennium Dome carried on our TV screens in front of us. Everything seemed still to be normal. And as a minute or two went by, we gingerly adjusted then to the fact that there had been no meltdown. And I'm saying that verse 7 puts us as readers through that kind of experience. Adam has eaten the fruit. And so we're bracing ourselves for death to strike. Verse 7, we're convinced, is going to be gory and it's going to be macabre. It's going to make us wince. And the verse starts to unfold. And we're still braced. And it unfolds a little bit more. And we find that we're watching Adam and Eve doing some sowing, of all things. And by the end of the verse then, we're gingerly adjusting to the fact that they aren't a pair of corpses sprawled on Eden's grass. No, life hasn't ended as chapter 2 verse 17 had indicated it would. Life has continued. Or has it? I want us to ponder that question. Has life continued now that Adam has disobeyed God? And the answer to that question is yes and no. Or better actually, no and yes. So there's a very important sense in which no, life hasn't continued. Life hasn't continued. Let's think about that for a moment. A few weeks ago, I was talking about chapter 2, verse 15, and the way in which Adam there is placed in the garden in order to do two things, remember, to work it and to keep it. And I said that that word keep in chapter 2, verse 15, it really means guard. And Eden needed guarding, because Eden contained treasure. And that treasure, I said, was communion with God. Adam and Eve experienced in Eden intimate communion with God. And with that in mind then, let's view now the scene here in chapter 3, verse 8. And the second half of that verse. The man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. And I suppose we could use different adjectives to describe that scene. We could describe it as foolish, couldn't we? This idea that Adam and Eve suddenly seem to have here, that the God who has just recently created the universe can be hidden from. As though he's able effortlessly to fill 100 billion galaxies with stars, but he'll be flummoxed by a few trees as long as Adam and Eve get far enough behind them. Then again, we could describe this scene as ironic. Trees in Eden are such a symbol of God's generosity, aren't they? Chapter 1, verse 29, I have given you every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them all for food. And here, Adam and Eve are cowering beneath these beautiful fruit-laden wonders. The very objects behind which they're hiding, screaming out the terrible mistake they have made. They are turning against the one who had given them these trees. They are turning against such a good and benevolent God. So there are these different adjectives we could use, but the adjective that captures the scene there in verse 8, best of all, I think, is this: tragic. Tragic. Because hiding from God like this, it's the absolute opposite, isn't it, of communing with God, enjoying God, which means then that Adam and Eve have lost that treasure that was theirs, that treasure which meant that Eden had to be guarded so carefully. They have lost the very best thing they had. They have lost that intimate closeness to God. And without that best thing, that focal thing, that central, all-important thing, without that, they aren't really alive anymore. They're existing still, but they aren't living now. I mean, look at them there, creeping about between the trees, whispering to each other, how can we get away from God? What if he sees us? And he wants to speak to us, perish the thought. Let's hope he goes away soon and leaves us alone. That's no life for human beings made to know God and to bask in God's presence. I'm saying stripped of that relationship that defined them, Adam and Eve are in a profound sense dead now. Breathing still, their eyes looking still, their ears hearing still, their hearts beating still, but in a profound sense, they're dead now because the very thing which defined their existence communion with God, the treasure that they had, it's gone. And they're hiding between the trees. And let me say this, you this evening also are, in a profound sense, dead. If you don't have this relationship that lies at the very heart of humanness. You might have lots of things. You might have good health and a big salary and a nice house and a stable family. But none of those can begin to compensate for the one thing that gives human existence its meaning and its purpose, intimacy with God. Without that, there is an empty, funereal lifelessness hanging over all the things you're trying to fill your days with. You need God. That's the simple fact of the matter. As we sang a moment ago in the psalm, He satisfies your deep desires from His unending stores of good. You need God to be truly alive. It's to have pulsating in your heart the limitless pleasure of fellowship with your Maker. So as I say, there's a very important sense in which the answer to our question is no. Life hasn't continued this side of Adam's eating. Not now that they've lost the very thing for which they exist, the treasure of knowing God. In an important sense, life hasn't continued. But then, there's a very important sense in which the answer is yes. Life has continued. You see, death in the Bible has at least three dimensions to it. There's the body expiring. That, I suppose, is what we all immediately think of when the word is used. There's the body expiring. That is one strand of death. Then again, there's what we've just been talking about. That condition where you're existing here on planet Earth, but devoid of that communion with God for which you were originally created. That's another strand of death. And then again, thirdly, there is being consigned by God to the lake of fire. Revelation chapter 20, verse 14 calls that death. And it then is death in its fullest, most ultimate form. Being banished absolutely from God's presence into the realm of hell. So there are, as I say, those three dimensions. And the very striking and remarkable thing is that Adam and Eve, having eaten the fruit, only experienced one of them. One of death's three strands. As we've said, they lose their intimate communion with God. And that's not a small thing. That's a major thing. It truly is tragic, as I said. But all the same, their bodies don't expire. And they aren't consigned to the fiery lake. It's a limited, partial experience of death that comes their way here. It doesn't come with anything like the severity that might have been expected. Life has continued. The fruit has been ingested. It has entered Adam's mouth. It has gone down his throat. It has reached his stomach. The prohibition of chapter 2, verse 17, that would incur death. So God said, that prohibition has been completely and unambiguously violated, and life has continued. Now, the first thing to say about that is that there's a very specific reason life has continued, which is this. God isn't giving up on this creation project of his that has gone pear-shaped. He could just do that, couldn't he? He could just shrug his shoulders at this point and walk away, done with the whole thing forever. In which case, Adam and Eve would get death in all its dimensions in one fell swoop. But no, God has plans. He's not going to throw in the towel. He's not going to wash his hands of matter and molecules and men, writing it all off as irremediable now. He has things up his sleeve. And so Adam and Eve mustn't drop dead on Eden's floor and go to hell. Instead, they must carry on living. Indeed, they must do some procreating. They must give birth to Seth, so that Seth can beget Enos, so that Enos can beget Canaan, so that Canaan can beget Mahalaleel, so that eventually, in the little town of Bethlehem, Mary can give birth to a boy called Jesus, who will put right everything that Adam has just done in this garden. So there's that very specific reason that life has continued. But there's something else. The continuing of life following the eating of the fruit, it also highlights, I think, a more general point, which is this. The gracious God of the Bible is a very reluctant punisher. The gracious God of the Bible is a very reluctant punisher. Again, in that psalm just now we sang, didn't we, those words about him being slow to anger. Slow to anger. Anger can come so quickly, can't it, to us human beings. Donald Trump couldn't contain his anger toward Israel as he spoke to the media the other day, and out of his mouth came some very unpresidential language. During the next 2 weeks, I'm sure that we'll see umpires at Wimbledon rebuking players whose anger has gotten the better of them, and rackets have been thrown on the ground and balls have been whacked into the crowd. We get so easily rattled, don't we? We get so easily hot under the collar. God isn't like that. I mean, his manner throughout our passage this evening is so unexpected, isn't it? It's so gentle and so measured. He could come out here all guns blazing against these rebellious creatures of his. But instead, he simply asks questions. Have you noticed that? God doesn't say a single thing here in this passage that isn't a question. Where are you? He asks. Who told you that you were naked? He asks. Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? He asks. What is this that you have done? He asks. By the way, that last question is quite something, isn't it? I wonder whether if you had been there in Eden that day and you had listened really carefully, you might even have detected a slight tremble in God's voice as he posed that final question. What is this that you have done? He's not really looking for an answer there from Eve, is he? She can't answer. She can't grasp the magnitude of what she has done. She can't grasp that she has just set in motion a train of events that will culminate in God's own son hanging from a wooden cross. But God knows that. And almost to himself then, his eyes moistening, perhaps we can say, he whispers the question here, Eve, Eve, what is this that you have done? But the point I'm really making is that God's whole manner throughout this passage, then it demonstrates such patience. And Adam and Eve continuing to live then after the eating of the fruit at the most basic level, that I think flows from the same thing, this extraordinary patience in the heart of God. Perhaps we can even put it like this. When God says in chapter 2, verse 17, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. He doesn't mean there, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die in some limited, partial, restricted sense, just one dimension of death. No, he means you shall surely die. But then when they do come to eat the fruit, such is his slowness to anger, such is his reluctance to punish, such is his impulse to relent and to spare that he gives Adam and Eve just the minimum sentence that he can possibly give them without breaking his word back in chapter 2 verse 17. And yes, they die. That just about satisfies the terms of the threat that he had made, but they only die in one of death's three dimensions. Because that's the kind of God that he is. Believer, you have a beautiful God. A God who isn't chomping at the bit to get vengeance whenever he's defied and disobeyed. A God who even in wrath and judgment is so merciful. Adore him, believer. Adore this God whose heart is so uninventably kind and patient and long-suffering. What a God. Life continued. But secondly, and more briefly this evening, liability contested. Liability contested. No one will take liability for the state of our economy, will they? So the government always blames the previous conservative government. The previous conservative government, on the other hand, it always blames the pandemic, and that got us into so much debt, and that's why we struggled so much with the economy. And so it goes on. There's this kind of continual passing of the buck. And it's a bit like that here in our passage, isn't it? As God asks all these questions, and first then Adam, he passes the buck, doesn't he? And then Eve, she does exactly the same, and she also passes the buck. And that's what I mean then by this second heading, liability contested. There's this contesting of who is liable going on here. And at one level then, it's a sad spectacle, isn't it? Especially Adam's passing the buck there in verse 12. Actually, with Adam, it's a kind of double passing of the buck, isn't it? Because when he says there in verse 12, the woman whom you gave me, so whom you gave to be with me, isn't there at least a little hint that he's actually laying the blame at God's feet? The woman you gave me. Again, it's that lie, isn't it, that we talked about last time, that Adam and Eve have come to believe. The lie that there is a lurking malevolence in the heart of God. And they've already fallen for the idea then that in prohibiting the tree, God was up to something sinister. And now Adam even seems to be entertaining the idea that in giving him Eve, God was up to something sinister. She wasn't actually the wonderful gift that he'd initially taken her for when he burst into song about her back in chapter 2. No, she was a honey trap. And God then had placed Eve in his life in order to pull him down. And so subtly, I'm saying, he seems here to be even blaming God. But of course, very unsubtly, he's blaming Eve there, isn't he, in verse 12? She gave me of the fruit, and I ate. It's so unhusbandly, isn't it? As he just picks up his wife and throws her under the bus. Remember I said a few weeks ago that the reason why they sow fig leaves together in verse 7 is because they can't trust each other anymore, Adam and Eve. Adam can't trust Eve anymore, not to judge him and find fault with him, and so he feels the need to cover up in her presence. And Eve can't trust Adam anymore, not to judge her and find fault with her, and so she feels the need to cover up in his presence. And here we have Adam doing precisely the thing that Eve feared, finding fault with his wife. It's her fault. She brought this mess on us all. Doesn't it make you yearn for a better kind of husband than Adam? Adam shifted the blame for his own failures onto his bride. Doesn't it make you yearn for a husband who will instead shift the blame for his bride's failures onto himself? Adam said, "She sinned." Even though really he had. Doesn't it make you yearn for a husband who will say, I sinned, even though really she had? And we have such a husband. A husband who at Calvary said, let me suffer. Let me take the hits. Let me be thrown under the bus. Let me be accounted guilty. Let me experience the horrors of hell, anything, so long as she, my beloved bride, the church, goes free. What a husband Jesus is. Such an infinitely better one than Adam. But I'm saying then at one level, all this contested liability here, it's a sad spectacle. But that's not quite the whole story, because I find it so interesting here that as the buck is passed, God takes what Adam and Eve are saying in passing the buck, he takes that at face value, doesn't he? So as Adam says there in verse 12, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate. God doesn't respond, whoa, 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 not so fast, Adam. You need to take a bit of personal responsibility here yourself, you know. No. Adam has passed the buck to Eve, and so what does God do? He turns now to Eve. And Eve then says, there in verse 13, the serpent deceived me, and I ate. And God doesn't say to Eve in the time-honored manner of school teachers, hang on a minute, Eve, if the serpent told you to jump off a cliff, would you do it? You've got your own brain inside that head of yours. I put it there. I know you have. Why didn't you use it? The serpent deceived me indeed. No, God doesn't say that. Eve has passed the buck to the serpent. So what does God do? He turns now to the serpent. And then on top of this intriguing phenomenon that I'm trying to draw your attention to here, we can take into account a couple of other factors. So the fact that when God does then turn to the serpent, and I know it's not in this evening's passage, but when God does turn to the serpent in the next part of Genesis 3, the tone altogether changes, doesn't it? There are no questions now. Remember I said all he does with Adam and Eve is ask questions. That's all he does. He doesn't ask the serpent any questions. He just fires devastating condemnation at him, that's all. And then, the other thing, the fact that there's a careful structure to this whole scene. And by the whole scene, I mean all the way from when God kind of comes into the garden here in verse 8, all the way down to verse 19, there's a very careful structure. Because do you notice that the focus then it moves from Adam, as God initially asks him a question, it moves from Adam to Eve, because the buck's been passed to her, to the serpent. There's that order, Adam, Eve, serpent. And then as God addresses the different parties, that order is reversed, isn't it? Serpent, Eve, Adam. That's the very careful structure. Adam, Eve, serpent, serpent, Eve, Adam. And it means then, and you probably think from this morning and from other sermons that I'm obsessed with center points, but it means that we have a center point here where God is addressing the serpent. That's right bang in the center. You can't miss it. Everything kind of draws us into that center where God is speaking face to face with the serpent. And remember, the serpent, we said last time, is really Satan. Satan's behind the serpent. And you put all this together then, and it seems that God actually wants to rush in our passage on from Adam and on from Eve. And he wants to get to the serpent as soon as possible, because in God's eyes, Satan's role is the key one here. In God's eyes, Satan is the villain here. Satan is the villain. And there's something wonderful about that that I think we can easily take for granted. In this moment, as Adam still has bits of that fruit stuck to his teeth and he's still gulping bits of it down, in this moment, as Adam has just done what he's done, in this moment, God is not consumed with hatred for mankind. He could have been, couldn't he? It'd be perfectly reasonable. But in this moment, God is not consumed with hatred for mankind. The rest of the Bible is not going to be the story of God making war on mankind and God going after man who has just rebelled against him and eaten the fruits. No, the rest of the story of the Bible is going to be God making war on Satan and God going after all the powers of darkness until he's finally dealt with every last one of them. There's one line in the Bible, and you all know it. There's one line which, again, we can so easily skip over, but which brings this out very marvelously. Do you remember how Jesus, in one of his parables, describes hell? Jesus describes hell in this way: the place prepared for the devil and his angels. Hell is not a place prepared for human beings. It's a place prepared for the devil and his angels. And yes, God will reluctantly send human beings to hell if they insist on siding with the devil and his angels. But hell is not a place for human beings, essentially. It's a place for the devil and his angels. God does not desire human beings to fill hell. God, I suppose I'm saying here, God has a pro-human stance. He does not have a pro-demon stance. He does not have a pro-devil stance. But he has a pro-human stance. To humans, he offers his heaven. To humans, he offers his son. To humans, he offers that blood of which we sang at the start of our service. To humans, he offers salvation, forgiveness, reconciliation. To humans, he offers himself. He offers everything. To no demon does he offer any of that. To no demon does he offer one single thing. And remember, the demons are angels. Angels who have rebelled just like Adam rebelled. And God offers them absolutely nothing. And he offers every single man and woman and boy and girl on this planet everything if they will come to him through faith in his son. What a God this is. And make sure that you are taking that offer that God makes to you tonight of salvation through his son Jesus Christ. None of you needs go to hell. None of you needs go to hell. If you were a fallen angel, I couldn't say that to you. If you were a fallen angel, you've got to go to hell. Because God's stance toward them is very different. But God is pro-man, pro-human, pro the descendants of Adam. And he has laid on for the whole of this race, for all in this race who will have it, a feast, a banquet of salvation. Receive it tonight. Come to this God who wonderfully is filled with venomous hatred for Satan and his demons in the Garden of Eden, but is not filled with venomous hatred for Adam and his descendants. Come to this God. Amen. Well, let's close singing from Sing Psalms.